Welcome to the Eucharist Podcast with Wyoming Catholic College, responding to the call for Eucharistic renewal by sharing wisdom in God's country. I'm Jeremy Holmes, Academic Dean at Wyoming Catholic College.
And I'm Kyle Washit, its President, and welcome to this episode.
Today is not just any Thursday for the podcast. Today is Holy Thursday, the day on which we celebrate the institution of the Eucharist.
In fact, this Thursday is the reason all of our other podcast episodes are on Thursday, because it's the Eucharist Day.
And Thursday is the day of the institution of the Eucharist, because at least in the chronology of the Synoptic Gospels, this is the day of the Passover meal, that one day in the year, which in its own way is a kind of culmination of Israelite liturgy. It's this day when the entire nation, in theory, converges on Jerusalem to offer a huge peace offering in which everyone, down to the last family member, is partaking. There's even this strong tradition of making sure the poor are able to eat the Passover, you know. So charity on the day of the Passover was paramount. You have to eat the Passover. And Jesus arranged to eat the Passover with his disciples. And, you know, of course, as we know, the custom would be that the leader of the Passover meal would be asked questions by perhaps a little boy or, you know, whoever's youngest in the assembly, and he would interpret the meal. Well, the interpretation that the chief rabbi gave this evening was like none other.
Right, right. All of a sudden, we're sitting there at the Passover supper, having this ritual, and Jesus radically changes forevermore what it will mean for the apostles to gather and celebrate a ritual meal. They've had meals before. They presumably have had Passovers before amongst the apostles. If you're a good Jew who lived within 90 miles of Jerusalem, the expectation was you were going to go to Jerusalem, you'd sacrifice the lamb, and you would eat that lamb in the context of the Passover supper within the city of Jerusalem. Jesus' ministry has stretched over probably around 3 years, so it's presumable this is not the first Passover he is eating with his disciples, but in a definitive way, it is the last, which is why it comes down in history as the Last Supper, not just chronologically the Last Supper he eats with the disciples, but a kind of definitive last Passover supper before a new covenant is instituted.
Yeah, around this time of year, one starts to see things about Christians wanting to celebrate a Christianized version of the Passover meal. And I always kind of boggle because Jesus sort of did that work for us. He did the work of Christianizing the Passover. In fact, he changed it in a way that none of us could by actually making the elements of that meal be his own body and blood.
Well, so before we jump into how radically the Eucharist changes the Passover, let's just do a little bit of background for the listeners about what the Passover ritual was beforehand, sort of like what we've done with manna and various other things.
Right. So, as you mentioned, earlier in the day, you have a lamb. Now, a lamb is not a small, 20-pound affair. This is a large animal, a year-old lamb, and you've taken it to the temple because this is a sacrifice, and sacrifice can only be offered at the temple. This is why this whole affair has to happen at Jerusalem. Everybody brings their lambs to the temple where it is slaughtered. They take it back, and at sunset, they begin the ritual meal, which by the first century AD had taken on a specific form, not really laid out for us in biblical text prior to the New Testament. So the meal was structured around four ritual cups of wine And in between those cups of wine, different courses of the meal were served. After the first cup, you would have a parsley with salt water, reminding everyone of the hyssop that you would sprinkle the blood over the door with. Then you would have your main course, and the main course involves obviously the lamb, but also unleavened bread. And the unleavened bread is recalling the fact that when the Israelites left Egypt, they were not only allowed to go by Pharaoh, they were in fact driven out so quickly they didn't have time to let the bread rise. And so their bread was unleavened, and they also would eat greens of various kinds that had a bitter taste to them, recalling the bitterness of slavery in Israel. They also, incidentally, had a wonderful sort of fruit mix and spice mix called haroset that they could slather onto the unleavened bread and bitter greens, and it made a pretty nice sandwich that the rabbis would put together.
But the haroset was, you know, if well mixed, at least a nod or a reference to the bricks and the mixing of the bricks in Egypt.
They would connect it to the mortar in between the bricks of the, you know, the pyramids that the slaves are building in Egypt. So it's this evening of using the meal itself as a kind of series of signs to pull back one by one the elements of the time of Israel in Egypt. And in fact, Rabbi Gamaliel is recorded to have said, it's the duty of every Israelite to consider that he himself was in Egypt and that tonight he is being freed, right? There's a present tense about the whole thing for the Israelite.
But it's not only a memory or a representation of the freeing from Egypt. There's also a celebratory sense to it, right? You're both remembering being freed from Egypt, but also already acknowledge you've been freed. So at this point in the first century, wine, sort of ritual drinking of wine's been introduced as a celebratory drink, along with bitter herbs and unleavened bread and lamb.
And this was the one night, really, when Jews would recline at table. Reclining was a Roman thing. It wasn't really the Jewish custom. But tonight, they are going to behave like masters and not like slaves. They are going to recline at table. And this is why we have that image in the New Testament. The emphasis on the fact that no matter what may be the historical condition around us, in fact, the Romans are over us right now, this is the night of our freedom.
So we have this ritual reenactment. There's some other things we want to note about it. We mentioned already, you have to eat it in Jerusalem because you're eating a temple sacrifice. The lamb has come to be a temple sacrifice, and you're eating it almost as a kingdom of priests within the holy city. But you also eat it in small groups, in family groups, or household groups of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, it is both the act of the entire kingdom of priests, but also in an intimate family setting.
Yeah, and Jerusalem would swell to many times its normal size. It just cram-jammed around this time of year. And, you know, one of those miracles that people don't really appreciate, you know, we notice the healing of the lame, the blind being given their sight, but the fact that Jesus got a room in Jerusalem at the last minute for the Passover, that's a miracle in its own right, right? That's like walking up to the stadium and getting Super Bowl tickets.
Right. So this is a big deal. It's also, we might want to note, some other themes that have crept in over time that have mixed with the Passover Supper. On the one hand, the celebration of the Davidic kings, their celebration of the Passover Supper is a big deal. There's various points in the Old Testament where there's a solemn celebration of the Passover Supper, implying that it hasn't happened for much of the history of the kings. And so there's a sense in which the celebration of the Passover Supper not only is a memory of Judah, of Israel leaving Egypt, not only is a celebration of the temple sacrifice, but in another sense, a celebration of the kingdom, of this Davidic covenant that God's made and the promise that there will be a king at some point in Jerusalem who will again celebrate this Passover supper. There's a hopefulness that, hey, if we're eating this as free, ultimately that means we're going to be a kingdom. Ultimately that means we're not going to be under Roman authority. So it's a big deal. You've got all of these key themes that are mixed up in Israelite history happening at the Passover moment. And I just want to say as an aside, the Seder meals that are now celebrated by our Jewish brethren aren't the Passover supper.
They can't be.
Because as we've stressed, part of what is essential to the Passover supper is you're eating a temple sacrifice. There hasn't been a temple sacrifice in almost 2,000 years. They cannot be celebrating the Passover supper as it was envisioned, as it was enacted by Christ and his disciples, or as it was enacted by the Israelites for however many centuries after they left Egypt. I just want to stress that after the temple falls, there is a fundamental change in the defining ritual of Israel as well.
Right, and we have to appreciate the situation in Egypt as really representing the situation of all mankind. That is, Israel at that point already is sort of symbolic of mankind. Pharaoh himself is a god in the Egyptian belief, and there's of course this pantheon of Egyptian gods. And when God speaks to Moses, he says that he's going to bring judgment on the gods of Egypt. So Israel shows us the situation of all mankind, including the Egyptians, as enslaved under false gods, enslaved under what St. Paul will say are demons, right? The situation of man after the fall of Adam, of having been sort of left to his own power and fallen in subjugation to dark powers. And so this is the situation that we are in, right? At birth, that we are born not in union with God through grace. And thankfully, Christianity has driven back some of the obvious reign of the dark powers. But there is still fundamentally the battle between God and Satan, represented by the captivity in Israel, captivity of Israel in Egypt.
And I was just reading this beautiful homily that Cardinal Ratzinger gave on the Passover, where he noted that Israel understood itself by celebrating the Passover in these family groups. It was a kind of sign of the ground-up approach of redemption, that God chose to establish redemption in these small groups that then went out to the freedom of Israel as a whole, but through Israel to ultimately the redemption of mankind. And he even notes that on the, at least perhaps on some of the earlier calendars, there was a link, certainly in rabbinic text as well, between the date of the Passover and the date of the creation of the world. That at some point, this enactment of the Passover, this spring ritual around the spring equinox, is a time of restoring all of the world back to what it has fallen into in slavery and the rest. And it's beginning in these family groups going out through the nation of Israel in the city of Jerusalem and ultimately promising to be there a redemption for the whole cosmos. And by the time you're celebrating in first century Israel, that sense of messianic expectation of we're going to have a celebration of a Passover that is going to redeem the city of Jerusalem, and from the city of Jerusalem, gather the lost tribes of Israel and ultimately gather the Gentiles back in. This is something that everyone's waiting for, everyone's expecting. And now the Messiah comes in prophesying his death, prophesying this moment of fulfillment. He's had this triumphal entrance to the temple, a kingly procession to the temple on Palm Sunday. And now we're celebrating this Last Supper, and the expectation is high that there's going to be a definitive moment where this redemption does finally break out and this Passover is going to fulfill the promise it's making of redeeming all mankind.
However, there comes a twist in the plot, right? Because the night of the Passover in Egypt was the night when the angel of death passed over the Israelites, and as a result, they were told to leave Egypt. That was sort of the night of the action. In the New Testament, it's sort of the introduction to the action, right? When we say that as Christians, our attention, of course, is riveted on the institution of the Eucharist and on the washing of the feet and those events of Holy Thursday, but we know that we're heading in even deeper into the center as we go into Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and ultimately Easter Sunday. So there's an interesting thing, right? This is the high point of Israel's liturgical year, the center of the action, and Christ is fulfilling it, but in his fulfillment of it, he doesn't just do everything Thursday night and maybe Friday morning. The action picks up. He's arrested tonight. But this is not the big day of the year for Christians.
And even in the language of the moment that changes the Passover, right? So we're presuming that most of the supper was a regular Passover supper. But all the synoptic gospels tell us that in the moment, in the midst of the eating, our Lord takes bread and he does something that's not in the Passover ritual. He takes that bread and he refers to it as my body. And then he says, which is given for you. But that giving doesn't actually happen until he's offered on the cross. So it begins to be happening here in the moment. But unlike the lamb, which has been sacrificed and now its body having been sacrificed is eaten, here Jesus seems to be saying, this bread is my body, which is going to be sacrificed. But that sacrifice hasn't yet happened. So all of a sudden we're in a different kind of a zone here. We're not looking back to a sacrifice of a lamb, but we're looking forward to our Lord giving up his body and our Lord pouring out his blood, which he says is the blood of a new covenant. So now all of a sudden, we're not just remembering what happened at Passover. We're offering a new covenant, not the Mosaic covenant, not the promise that God gave to Moses, not the promise that God gave to David, but the promise of the new covenant, that ultimate redemption that we've been waiting for since the Mosaic covenant, since the Davidic covenant. And our Lord's saying, it's coming, and I'm making it present to you now in bread and wine.
Yeah, there's a sort of messing around with chronological time that goes on here, right? This is not Good Friday, but it kind of is Good Friday. And this he has not yet given his body, but he's saying this is my body, which is given for you. But then this is interesting. So we're starting to get into a little bit of why Holy Thursday is the day of the institution of the Eucharist, but Thursday is not the big day for Christians. All right. But what we've said so far kind of makes it sound like, well, then Friday should be the big day.
Right.
But Friday's not the day that's burned into our imaginations as the day of worship. That day is actually Sunday.
Right. So all of a sudden, this ritual institution that happens on Thursday doesn't really come to full flower until Sunday. And that Sunday becomes the day of the Eucharist. So granted, we release our podcast on Thursdays as a remembrance of Thursday's the day of the Last Supper. But if you ask everyone, when's the day of the Eucharist?
Sunday, yeah.
It's Sunday.
Absolutely.
So all of a sudden, this line from Holy Thursday through Sunday are collapsing into an event. That the moment when we do the action that our Lord says, do this in remembrance of me, as Catholic Christians, we think, oh, that means we celebrate this on Sunday.
I know, and we can just grab a few connections to what we've said that will start to make sense of this, right? So if Thursday was the night of the Passover, which is the night of the coming out of Egypt, when does that happen on the Christian scale of things? Well, it's Christ's rising from the dead that is the ultimate sort of coming out of Egypt. Right, coming out of the kingdom of bondage and death. And we had said that the Passover was understood as a day of the new creation. Well, what is the day of new creation for Christians? Well, it's the eighth day, right? It's Sunday. It's Christ inaugurates the new creation when he rises from the dead. So it's when you get down into... what was the Passover and therefore what is its fulfillment, that we find we're looking not only at the day on which the lamb is sacrificed, Friday, but even more ultimately at Easter itself.
So here's, I think, a really amazing thing that emerges from this as we think about what happens at the Lord's Supper. This is on my mind because I don't know if this has happened to you, but around the week before Holy Thursday, maybe a couple weeks before, that's when the Jehovah's Witnesses come out in town, and they come door to door, and they come knocking, and they give a little pamphlet, and they say, hey, we'll be gathering on Holy Thursday for our commemoration of the Last Supper, of Lord's Supper. And we do this once a year. We do this once a year because as the Passover, that's what we did in Jerusalem. And so now as the new Christians, that's what we do once a year. We have Holy Supper dinner on Holy Thursday.
And there's some logic to that. You could say the Passover was a once-a-year event. This is a one-for-one substitution. Now, we've just offered some reasons why, for Christians, when you swap in what Christ has done for the Passover, it's going to land on a Sunday for us. But we can still ask, so then why not have the Eucharist celebrated once a year on Easter Sunday?
Right. So already we've touched at one thing, that in instituting the Lord's Supper on Holy Thursday, our Lord's letting us know this is a kind of ritual sign that looks to events beyond just what happens on Thursday. It looks to events that happen on Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and on Easter Sunday. And we've talked about that when we've talked about the sacrifice of the Mass and the sacrifice of the liturgy. So there's a way in which, okay, this is a ritual reenactment. Why should it be ritually reenacted weekly? Well, on the one hand, we want to stress one important point. When our Lord says a new covenant, he's replacing the entire system of temple sacrifices. There's no longer going to be a sacrifice in the temple. We don't need a lamb sacrifice to offer the Holy Supper anymore. Now our Lord's replaced that with himself on Good Friday.
You might say that the moment he said those words, the temple in Jerusalem was doomed.
It was done. And so for the Christians, in fact, they saw it that way. When the temple fell under the Roman invasion of Jerusalem, and there could never be the offering of a lamb sacrifice in the temple again, the Christians saw, yes, that's just the historical fulfillment of the reality that was affected on Holy Thursday.
And the temple sacrificial system, which was really meant to meet the needs, the real needs of the people in relation to God, had sacrifices offered every day. Not only because people happen to sin a lot and you have to bring in sin offerings, but there are just regular recurring pre-scheduled sacrifices that happen daily, as well as the occasional sacrifices you might need because of this or that event.
And come the first century Jerusalem, Passover, because the Jews had been dispersed all throughout not just the land of Israel, but into Egypt, into various other places, Passover had become kind of the stand representation for the entire sacrificial system. Philo of Alexandria is a Jew writing. He says, oh yeah, of course, there's sacrifices every day. But at the minimum, as a Jew, you participate in all those daily sacrifices by going to Passover and then remembering it in some way. But there's this sense of, and then Philo will say especially, the way you remember all the daily sacrifices if you can't be at the temple is you remember those daily sacrifices on the Sabbath. You enter into the Sabbath and it becomes a kind of weekly remembrance of Passover, and a weekly remember of all of the sacrifices that are being offered when you, as a Jew living in Alexandria, can't possibly go to the temple every day.
And in fact, there's an element of Passover in the Sabbath, inasmuch as on the Sabbath, Jewish law rigorously equalized everyone. The slave gets the Sabbath off, as well as the master. The master cannot demand work because, hey, I'm having my Sabbath, go cook my meal, right? Everyone is equalized in the face of the Sabbath, which is, by the way, very weird for Romans, who didn't have any corresponding reality in their culture. And so there's a kind of ennoblement of the lowest in society that really does recall the day of freedom, right? The Passover. And so it makes a lot of sense that when you replace the Passover, you are replacing the Sabbath as well.
Right, you're replacing the entire Old Testament cult, the daily system of sacrifices, the liturgical calendar of the Jewish year, and the Sabbath. and you're replacing that with some kind of ritual reenactment of eating bread that is itself the body of the sacrificed. But, as we've said before, not just the body of the sacrificed, but the body of the sacrificed having been passed over from death to life. The sacrificed who is now alive. And that becomes the focus of the Christian cult. And if you're saying that, from very early on, the Christians recognize this is not a once-a-year commemoration. St. Paul's saying, when you gather for the Lord's Supper to eat Christ, our Passover lamb who has been sacrificed in remembrance of this, he's imagining this, he's envisioning this as a regular occurrence in the life of the church in Corinth, for example, or the life of any Christian church. They're gathering and they have this celebration that has replaced the entire structure of the Old Testament worship and culminated in this commemoration of not just the Last Supper, but of the sacrifice on Good Friday and the resurrection on Easter.
And we should mention, while we're replacing that entire system, we replace the priesthood as well.
Right.
Christ is the high priest, and now all subsequent priesthood will be rooted in him. In a share in him.
Exactly. That there's something special about the Passover for the Jewish mind. They're eating as priests. They do various things that show they're eating as priests, but it's still an Aaronite priesthood. That's gone. Everything is centered on the sacrifice that Christ offers through the hands of his apostles.
Thank you for listening to the Eucharistic Podcast at Wyoming Catholic College. To learn more about Wyoming Catholic College, visit wyomingcatholic.edu.